So relational literacy, you know, which I describe or define as the understanding of an ability to practice healthy ways of relating, is such a game changer. Just like literacy is a game changer. Like the difference between being able to read and write and not being able to read and write in the world is so fundamental. The difference between having like a relatively decent level of relational literacy and not is so fundamental. When you build relational literacy enough, everything changes. So much in your life changes, and so much of how you affect others changes. It's and because our collective level of relational literacy is so low, all we have to do is build it by like 10%, and it's a game changer.
Hello.
Oh, that was nice. Here are the two German Kartoffels talking English to each other.
About?
Melanie Joy.
Who is she?
She's a psychologist and an author and founded several NGOs and just a very, very inspiring person that I basically found during my time of like becoming vegan and also starting to inform myself a lot about the topic. Like, she's a vegan advocate and... Mm-hmm.
I guess Even if you're not vegan, you can take so much from her work. Obviously, besides veganism.
I mean, what she does so wonderfully, I think, is with her background in psychology, showing how all of the topics of oppression and abusing power is basically linked to us having relationships with each other, with ourselves, with our environment,
animals.
True. And I think one of the things that she got most known for is her framing of the term carnism, which as opposed to a lot of people thinking that only veganism is based on a belief system, she argues that eating animals is also based on a belief system in a society where it's not necessary to do that in order to survive. And that belief system that conditions us to eat certain animals is called carnism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess that's one thing. And then the other, as you mentioned, is just... I mean, I read this, Getting Relationships Right, in preparation for this interview.
It's a book of hers, right?
It's a book of hers, true. And even if a lot of the things in there seem so plausible, it's so nice to have them like explained one more time and see the importance. Because as she said, oftentimes when it comes to relationships, we never get any education. It was very nice to talk to her and get more information and her view.
Yeah, I feel like all of what she gives to people through her like literature and her talks is just so valuable for our everyday life in order to become more compassionate and become more aware and become better at having like really good relationships with other people and with ourselves and also with animals.
And that's why everyone should listen.
Yes, have fun.
Have fun.
All right, so then, shall we just hit recording and start?
I did.
Perfect. All right, then. Hi, and welcome to another episode of Ein Pod Kaffee, today with Dr. Melanie Joy. Melanie, first of all, thank you for taking the time for us.
Well, thank you. It's really a pleasure. As I was saying, it's very rare that I have an interview with people who have done such a thorough job of looking at my writing and work before interviewing me. And so I'm especially looking forward to this conversation. It's really a pleasure.
Yeah, we were too. I mean, I told Tjelven when we talked to each other, but I'm actually like probably more nervous than before our usual talks, because I mean, for once we're very excited about your work and we've read and talked about it a lot in the past couple of days and weeks. And also, I mean, you're probably the guest that I've spent the most effort of trying to get an interview with, because I even got a job with your husband just to talk to you. Maybe to start off, something that stuck with me when I read your book called Powerarchy is that you started with a quote of Rumi, which is, "If you find the mirror of the heart dull, the rust has not been cleared from its face." Mm-hmm. And you're actually the second person to quote Rumi on this podcast. Mm-hmm. So we're wondering, what does that quote mean to you?
Yeah, I guess to me, it means that when we remove the external and also internal, but stressors from our experience or from our lives, then we're better able to access our more compassionate natures. You know, we've all been born into a lot of dysfunction. Most places in the world, you know, don't have very high levels of relational literacy, which we'll talk about later. And the vast majority of us get fractured, you know, just coming into this life, we're fractured in various ways. And we try to be our better selves or our more compassionate selves. We know that humans are hardwired to seek connection and some other animals as well, and to avoid the pain of disconnection, and that we're also hardwired to feel empathy for others. And at the same time, we so often really struggle to connect with our empathic and more compassionate natures. But it's really, I guess, another way to say this is that the opposite of trauma is love. You know, when we take away the trauma, when we heal some of the fractures, then we can reconnect with our, you know, more loving, compassionate natures.
You already touched upon the topic of relational literacy, and as you said, we'll get more in depth later. But if we look at your work, at the core of almost everything there are relationships, and we were wondering how did it all start? Why was this topic so fascinating when you first got into it?
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right that at the core of all of my work is relational health. I very much believe that the most significant problems that we're grappling with in the world and in our personal lives are problems that result from relational problems, relational dysfunction. And so the way to work towards solving those problems is to build greater relational health, which I know we'll talk about a bit more later. For me, I have witnessed so many people suffering tremendously due to relational dysfunction or problems in their relationships, problems with attachment that started early on in their lives, in their, you know, family systems, problems with their intimate relationships. I mean, I'm sure this is not a surprise to listeners or to you guys. Most of us can relate to the fact that a tremendous source of pain and suffering in our lives is from problems in our relationships. They're also a great source of joy as well. But I had seen a lot of suffering, and I also experienced it myself. I had some real suffering when I was growing up and in my early adulthood as well. And I spent time myself in therapy, working on my own relational healing over the years, I came to really understand that that not only is the source of so much suffering relational, but the source of so much potential for transformation is also therefore relational. And I've worked as a relationship coach for a long time. I'm very interested, obviously, in active and social transformation. But before I was even doing that work, I was working as a relationship coach, supporting people in their own relational transformation. So it was sort of like a natural marriage of my work as a relationship coach and psychologist and with my work in social justice and animal rights.
Mm-hmm. I think when I started seeing your work for the first time, I really made that connection between things that happen in our society, like racism, sexism, or carnism, as you framed it, and relationships. Like beforehand, that wasn't really connected for me. And I was just curious when I read your book, that this thought came striking back at me, that what you've noticed before, that we are deep down all kind beings and strive for connection. And at the same time, our society has built up these systems more or less naturally. I mean, we didn't intentionally set up a racist society or a carnistic society, I guess, but they just formed from our relationships that naturally evolved. How do you think that goes together, us being kind and loving and deep down and still having these oppressive systems?
Well, it's an interesting question. And we are kind and loving in many ways deep down. And we also, you know, are still biological beings who are hardwired to respond to threats, physical or threats to us physically, that are physical or threats to us, you know, psychological threats to us. We're hardwired to respond with defensiveness and also aggression. So I don't want to promote this Pollyanna-ish view of human nature that we're all good. I don't even think, you know, that thinking in terms of good and bad is particularly useful. So I shouldn't abuse that word. But we have, you know, one thing that we do know and that research does show us is that when we are not under threat, when we do not feel that we're under threat, we don't perceive threats to our dignity, you know, our sense of self, to ourselves psychologically or emotionally or physically, then we're in a better position to access our more compassionate natures. And at the same time, you know, we also know that most of us share the core moral values of compassion and justice, which is caring and fairness. Most of us really do want to feel that we're living a moral life. Most of us really do need to feel that we're behaving in ways that are not cruel and that are not unfair. Like, this really matters to us, and we really do want meaningful connections in our lives with others and with ourselves. And yet, because so much of our choices, our relational choices, our minute-to-minute life choices have been largely unconscious, you know, over time. We're like a fairly young species. We have built structures. We have created, you know, these social structures that really do not serve our interests on this deeper level. So we live with this contradiction. On one hand, we live within these systems, these systems of oppression, as you pointed out, these various isms that run counter to our true, our you know, desire to live ethical lives. And on the other hand, we all participate in these systems because this is just what we've been conditioned to do. So most of us live with this internal disconnect. You know, we're feeding racism, we're feeding sexism, we're feeding carnism, and we don't feel good about that. And on top of it, we're not even aware of the fact that there's this disconnect because we haven't even been taught to be mindful and to observe ourselves so that we notice that internally we're not as present, we're not as aligned, we're not as authentic, we're not as connected with our empathy as we could be.
What is, I mean, as you pointed out, the first step is becoming aware of it. And I guess for some of the isms that you just described, this is happening. I mean, slower than it should be, but it is happening. But still, it still seems sometimes very far from breaking those systems. What is keeping us from doing that? Although even we somehow might be aware, is it just that we need the majority of people or?
Well, awareness, I mean, that's a great question and it's a huge question. Awareness is really, it's not just an intellectual experience. It's not just cognitive. True awareness is emotional as well. You know, so we might be, you know, sometimes people say, oh, I'm aware of the problem, meaning I recognize it with my mind, but they don't actually empathize with those who are impacted by the problem. They don't make this empathic connection. And of course, awareness exists on various levels. So I think an important first step is becoming truly aware, like becoming truly informed of, you know, systems of oppression. How are they structured? How do they operate? Perhaps most importantly, how do they affect us psychologically? What is the story that they teach us to believe in? Once we become aware, you know, studies have shown that when you become aware of your cognitive biases, these biases that we have, you know, for example, that, you know, men are more rational than women, for example, to give an example of a patriarchal bias, that when we become aware of our biases, we're less likely to be impacted by them. And so becoming aware of the systems, becoming aware of the impact of those systems on others and on ourselves, and developing on a deeper level, just developing self-awareness, developing the ability to witness ourselves to the best of our ability so that we notice when we're out of alignment. Once you start making a practice of observing yourself, you start to notice when you're out of alignment, when you're not thinking and living in a way that resonates with the person you really want to be on this planet. And so it's almost like you become your own coach that's with you. Now, you asked about changing these systems. I think you were asking about what can we do to work to change the systems besides raising awareness. I think awareness raising obviously is key, not only in ourselves, but also in others. And committing to changing the way that we operate within these systems and really committing to become as relationally healthy as possible. So there are many people just doing incredible work, working to transform different systems of oppression. And it would be really beneficial if we all were committed to working on ourselves in the process of working on transforming society, because one of the problems we end up with is that if we don't identify the deeper level of the problem, which I believe is relational dysfunction and how we relate to power, we can very easily and almost automatically end up becoming the very thing we're trying to transform. And I know you guys know what I'm talking about. You see movements like, you know, the vegan movement is a good example, people doing amazing work and an incredibly important social justice movement, and also a movement that is in some ways cannibalizing itself with toxic internal dynamics.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Like when I think back of when I first became vegan, I mean, I've been vegetarian for, I don't know, 7 years, and that's been very easy. You just say I'm vegetarian. Everybody's like, okay, fine. And then, I don't know, 1 or 2 years ago, I became vegan. And when I started researching into the implications of the consumption of animal products, I mean, all these facts and all these horrible things that happened just overwhelmed me, and it became huge in my mind. And obviously, I talked to a lot of my friends about it, and I think then started engaging in discussions with them, which somehow took strains on our friendships because maybe they didn't want to be annoyed with that. And I was wondering, since you're doing advocacy on a professional level, if have you encountered the same problems when you first got there? Do you still encounter them today? And how do we get better at raising awareness for these issues that are maybe not as widely accepted as it's okay to raise awareness for?
Yeah, it's a great question. I did when I first became vegetarian and then quickly thereafter vegan. This was back in 1989. So, you know, there was much less awareness of the issue back then. And I don't know if people were more defensive back then than they are today. I'm not really sure. I think so. But nevertheless, there was a lot less awareness. And in the early days of my veganism, I did experience, you know, of course, I was teased and often mocked. And people didn't understand. My mother looked at me like I had, you know, people would look at me like I had two heads. My mother thought I wasn't going to live to see my 30th birthday. I was 23 at the time. And my mother has recently become vegan in the past few years, in her 70s. So times have changed. It helps when your daughter writes books on the subject that you feel obligated to read. But yes, so I did experience this resistance. And this is exactly what led me to do my research on carnism, on the psychology of eating animals, and to really understand. What I studied when I was a graduate student in psychology, this is what led me to do my studies in general. And I focused on the psychology of violence and nonviolence more broadly, and then wrote my dissertation, my thesis on the psychology of eating animals. And it was because of this resistance that I experienced with my own inner circle, my family and friends. And they weren't terribly hostile, but they would tease me, and they were, you know, had varying levels of resistance. And I thought, these are people who are rational, just like I am. They're compassionate, just like I am. We have a dog together, you know, they care about animals, and yet they are treating me as though something is wrong with me because I actually don't want to participate in completely unnecessary and intensive violence toward billions of individuals, non-human individuals. And so this was what led me to identify what I came to call carnism, the invisible belief system that conditions people to eat certain animals, and really also to feel so committed to building my own ability to communicate effectively and to be as relationally healthy as I could be, because I, you know, like you, I'm an ambassador for the causes that I believe in. And to be an effective ambassador, I need to be able to represent and communicate about the issues as well as possible. And as I'm sure you guys know, you can communicate about these issues perfectly, and people still might be resistant. And I also, you know, because the resistance is just built into the mentality. And I also don't want, you know, people who are activists or advocates to feel like they have yet another burden, like, oh no, now I have to worry about being a perfect advocate because I was listening to Melanie Joy say, work on your communication. Like, we already have a heavy burden. You know, think of this on a spectrum, just, you know, work toward improving communication.
Mm-hmm. I found in the past that, I don't know, this having compassion with yourself just, I don't know, struck with me, because in the past I've been in a situation where generally, like, veganism is really easy for me. I like to cook, and I've been in the space to know what I like. And I don't know, I think there's so much plant-based food that it's just like, it's easy to make delicious meals that I don't miss anything. But recently I've had this situation where, I don't know, I've met a new girl, and we've and had some weekends together where we Sunday morning would walk around the park, and then there was a bakery and they only had like normal butter-based croissants. And in this moment, I felt so in the moment that I sort of didn't think about it, and I ate a croissant. And that might sound ridiculous to people who are not vegan, but afterwards that sort of came back and haunted me, because I thought, why did you do that? Like, animals suffered for that, and you valued your taste pleasure more now. And I know that leaves me in some sort of conflict, because at the same time, I want to be able to enjoy these moments if there's not really. And obviously there is another way, like just not having the croissant would be another way, but somehow I decided to having it. And I don't really know how to find peace with that. Like, do I have to be morally perfect? Or should I strive for that? Or I don't know if you have any advice for that.
I mean, so I think we have an expression in English, and I think you have it in German too, that the perfect is the enemy of the good. Mm-hmm. People, you know, sometimes ask me, and they hear that I'm vegan, and you know, they'll say like, oh, well, certainly in the past, you know, where veganism was less well known. But even now, to say vegan, like, so what do you mean you don't eat? You only eat fish? And I'm like, no. What do you mean you don't wear leather? Inevitably, they end up asking me, like, you know, so where do you draw the line around your circle of compassion? Where do you draw your line? And I always say, it's not where I draw my line that matters to me. It's how I relate to my line. And I think that's really important for all of us. It's not where we draw the line around our circle of compassion. It's how we relate to our line. And that means, I mean, we have days that we're not, you know, practicing days. We have moments. We all do this because we've been born into a very imperfect world. And we have to make choices in this very imperfect world that are different than the choices we would make if the world were perfect, if it were different. And, you know, so it's really like when we say things to the people that we love that we later regret because we were angry, and we say, oh my God, I know better. I understand relationships. I shouldn't have said something like this. I shouldn't have acted this way. We always, many of us do things in the moment that we, in hindsight, think to ourselves, well, maybe there was a different way of doing that. Maybe there was a better way of doing that. Maybe I shouldn't have had that, you know, extra bite of cake because it's got sugar in it and sugar's not good for me. Or I shouldn't have eaten that croissant because it's got butter in it and I'm vegan. But this is the nature of being a human being on a very, you know, imperfect planet, It's not where you draw your line, it's how you relate to your line. So you look at that. You look at that decision you made and be curious about it and be curious about yourself and have compassion for yourself. And I always say to vegans, let impact be your guide. You know, there's, you know, sometimes I wonder, I don't wear leather shoes because I don't want to promote leather. But I buy shoes that are made of vinyl, which is not good for the environment. And I don't know what's the better choice. So we're always making choices and we're always making trade-offs. And we just have to live with the fact that we all are full of contradictions. And that is a part of being human on a planet that is so full of contradictions itself.
I guess it's also very important to keep in mind that relationships are not only towards someone else or society, but also, of course, and most of the time towards ourselves. And very thankfully, you also wrote a book about relationships called Getting Relationships Right. And in this book, and I guess we also use this term already in this podcast, you talk a lot about relational literacy. You just said that you think we're still in the dark ages of relationships. So that means, or basically means that, or frames the ability to understand and practice healthy ways of relating. And you compare in the book, you compare it to learning a new language. And I really liked the comparison. But then I figured I was thinking about there are a lot of people offering to teach languages. And there are also a lot of people willing to learn new languages. But when I think about teaching the art of relationships and people willing to actively invest time into learning how to get better in relationships, there's not so much supply and demand. And I was thinking, is it really possible? Are we really able to get better in relationships on our own? Isn't that quite a high standard? Because it's so easy to fall back into habits and how you behave at the moment.
Yeah. So relational literacy, you know, which I describe or define as the understanding of an ability to practice healthy ways of relating, is such a game changer. Just like literacy is a game changer. Like the difference between being able to read and write and not being able to read and write in the world is so fundamental. The difference between having like a relatively decent level of relational literacy and not is so fundamental. When you build relational literacy enough, everything changes. So much in your life changes and so much of how you affect others changes. It's and because our collective level of relational literacy is so low, all we have to do is build it by like 10% and it's a game changer. And so in answer to your question, people can absolutely build relational literacy and change their relationships and change their lives and change the world. Absolutely. I've said this before and I'll say it again. I'm always amazed that most of us have to learn complicated geometry that we'll probably never need to use. And yet we don't get a single formal lesson on how to be healthy relational beings. And so even because so many of us never receive a single formal lesson in how to relate in a way that's healthy, learning just a little bit can go a really long way. And so, you know, again, the first step is awareness. And you talked about people not being willing to or interested in learning about relational literacy. That's also connected to awareness. Many, many people would agree that the primary suffering in their lives comes from problems in relationships, whether it's problems with their leadership, you know, trying to running an organization or teams, whether it's problems with coworkers or their neighbors or their intimate partner or their children or their parents. Many people would say that this is where they struggle. It's just that they don't realize that there are, in fact, you know, principles and tools. This is not rocket science. You know, the code was cracked a long time ago. There are like really brilliant people working in the relationship space, writing really good books and doing amazing research. Like we've cracked the code enough to know what basically we need to know in order to change the way we relate so that we can be healthier beings and create a healthier world. And that was why I wrote Getting Relationships Right, because I was doing relationship coaching. I was you know, also just with people in my own life who would come to me and ask for my advice and support. And I was like, oh my God, I just want one book I can hand you and say, read this. And it's got all of the basics to help you do what you need to do and make the changes you need to make. And then you can go on from there and learn more, you know, if you want about some of the specifics. Go ahead.
Yeah, I figured while reading your book, what I really appreciated was that you explained so many things in such a plausible way that it really truly doesn't sound like rocket science to become better in relationships. And at the same time, I feel like a prerequisite is most of the times to be present in the moment in order to do the right thing in the and just be able to make a conscious decision on how you want to behave towards someone else or yourself. And this is what I feel like is the biggest challenge. Like constantly being mindful and present is something I'd wish I'd be able to, but still seems far from how I normally move through my day. So, are you able to be present most of the time?
I mean, it's a process. It is a process. I don't know anybody who's mindful and present all the time, or even most of the time, to be honest. So it's really like, you know, building relational literacy. It's not all or nothing. It's not you're relationally literate or you're not. You know, your relationship's healthy or it's dysfunctional. It's just a matter of how much. And again, it's like, it's not where you are on the spectrum of relational literacy that's most important, in my opinion. It's the direction you're heading in. And it is a process. And, you know, people who really are committed can certainly learn it. There's great work out there. There are trainings. We are putting together more trainings in our organization through Beyond Carnism and the Center for Effective Vegan Advocacy. And we're building specifically trainings on relational literacy now. And you're absolutely right when you say that being present is fundamental to practicing healthy ways of relating. And the interesting thing is that the more you practice some of the behaviors that are healthy relational behaviors, and we can talk about exactly what those are if you want to, but the more you practice these behaviors, the more present you become as well. I talk about this as like, I describe it as sort of relational mindfulness. You know, where we build mindfulness, not simply by sitting and meditating, which I'm not knocking, it's very important practice, there's no question, but we can become more mindful and more present through practicing healthy ways of relating. So really listening, really tuning in, really trying to be authentic in your interactions. And as for me, how present am I in a day-to-day basis? I guess you'd have to ask my husband the answer to that. I can certainly say that I'm much more present than I used to be, but that's because I've been working on being more present over a number of years. And that's what I would say to you, that this is a process. And this is why developing the inner observer is so important. It's just like your inner observer is that part of you that's always been there, that always will be, that is watching you, that is witnessing. It's the objective, compassionate witness that is always accessible to you to a greater or lesser degree. And your inner observer is just noticing what you're experiencing without making up a story about it, without judging it. It's just noticing with compassion. And the inner observer, it's like a muscle. It grows with practice. And the more you work on building this inner observer, the easier it is for you to be present and the less likely you are to get hijacked and by your emotions or your narrative and then end up acting in ways that you wish you hadn't.
For more on that, just please read Melanie's book. Like, we can really recommend them. And we'll talk more about that probably in our next episode of Kalter Kaffee as well. But one more like sort of category of questions that we always have is, we have this small Patreon community, which is a community of supporters, where every time when we speak to a guest a few days prior to that, we tell them about our guest and then they can hand in questions that we then take into the conversation. And one of our patrons asked that you, as an activist and psychologist and expert in relationships, how do you perceive the polarization within our society, whether it be populism, like COVID conspiracies, or of course carnism versus veganism. Like, what do you make of what do you make of this?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question. I think the current state of our world right now is the inevitable end result of the combination of, you know, the advanced state of our technology, where like we can be connected with like millions of people in various ways. The combination of that, coupled with our low level of relational literacy, I would say. It's like the Center for Humane Technology points out that our technology has exceeded our capacity to manage it in a healthy way. And so I'm not surprised that we're at this state of intense increased polarization. I mean, another way to think about what I'm saying is from a perspective, a more maybe Buddhist perspective, Eckhart Tolle, whose writing I love, he speaks from a spiritual perspective, but he talks about the ego. And, you know, if we were all, you know, trained early in life in mindfulness and given the tools to really understand ourselves and relate in a healthy way, then we would be relating to our technology, which is giving us the ability to have a lot of communication and do a lot of things, concentrate a lot of power. We would be relating to that in a very different way. But I'm not at all surprised at the state of our world, given the state of our current level of awareness.
Are you hopeful nonetheless? Like, do you see, are you seeing a compassionate world in this decade? Or not even, maybe not in this decade, but maybe in this century more?
I don't know about this decade.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting. Right. That's a little ambitious, but, you know, we can see the trajectory. I mean, it's very clear that there's like certainly an evolution of consciousness around like really critical social issues. You know, Black Lives Matter is a good, you know, I think indication of race consciousness, the growth of race consciousness when we compare where we are today in the conversation to where we were just 10 years ago. Not to say we don't have a long way to go, but, you know, even consciousness around carnism and eating animals has grown tremendously. So consciousness around critical social issues is certainly growing. And nevertheless, we are also, you know, we don't have that much time to turn around our behaviors if we hope to have a planet to leave to future generations. So the answer to your question is, I don't know. We're evolving in the right direction psychologically, but we may not grow fast enough. We may not evolve quickly enough to prevent ourselves from, from ecocide, essentially.
Before we slowly come to an end, we have two more things we'd like to talk about. One is, prior to the interview, we sent you a briefing telling you about what we are going to basically talk about and what we want to know. And one of the questions that we asked you in there was if you have had a like outstanding learning throughout your life, and you answered to that with to be inspired and able to create positive change is a privilege. Could you maybe elaborate a bit more on that?
Yeah. I mean, I've had a lot of learnings that, you know, as we all have, life is full of learnings. But this is one that's been more, it's been very, very important to me. And it's probably because I work in advocacy circles. People who are advocating for really important social change, you know, animal rights, social justice, and who feel incredibly frustrated and often despairing and misanthropic. Because they're consistently facing people who are resisting their message, and their message is one of compassion. And I think it's really important to appreciate that the capacity to feel compassion and to feel inspired to do this positive, you know, this positive change work, it is a privilege. If you think about your experience after just one bad day, you know, one of those days where everything goes wrong, where you move into a new flat and things don't work out properly the first day you get there, or you're traveling and you're in economy and you're on Ryanair and your knees are up under your chin and the people next to you are like shoving their elbows into you. You know, one of those days where things just all go wrong and you're just more and more and more and more and more frustrated. By the end of the day, you're probably not liking who you are. You probably don't like who you are. It's probably difficult for you to access your compassionate self. And all you want to do is snap at people and tell them to get out of your way. And that's a really terrible way to feel. And when you're able to be in a state of compassion, and then on top of that, to inspire other people to come into a state of compassion, what that means is that you have been privileged not to be relationally harmed and frustrated in ways that block you from that part of yourself. So rather than be angry at people who aren't being compassionate enough, be grateful that you are able to stay, be in a place of an open heart, because you are suffering less than they are.
That's very well said. That's very beautiful, I feel. And strong. You are the last guest of our second season of iPod Café. And in this season, I said I'm not going to explain it now, I'm doing it anyways. We always have three questions in the end from a German author called Max Frisch and a book called Fragebogen. And I guess we've talked a lot about your work, and I guess those questions might give us a bit more insight, if you're willing, into who you are as a person. So I'm going to kick it off with the first one, which is, if your current partnership can be described as happy, to what do you attribute that?
My current partnership is definitely happy. It's definitely healthy. I attribute a lot of that to my husband, to Sebastian, who is a very relationally healthy person and a relationally healthy partner. He's what is called securely attached in the psychology literature. He has a healthy way of relating to people in general, and particularly to primary attachments. And he's just a remarkable human being who is very low in ego. He's one of the least defensive people I've ever met in my life. You can pretty much tell him anything and he'll listen openly, and respond honestly. And that makes partnership very, very easy when you have, you know, the lower the defensiveness, the easier the partnership. So we work well together, and I think his generosity and his commitment to being a kind and supportive and healthy partner makes my life a lot easier.
And the second question is, do you consider yourself a good friend?
I do consider myself a good friend, and my friends tell me that I'm a good friend. So I think my self-perception is right, but I don't know. Maybe there are some friends that feel differently, but I certainly try to be a good friend.
Nice. And the last one is, when you realize that you live in an amoral society, does it satisfy you that at least you behave morally?
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't 100% understand this, but I think it's a society that's, because society itself doesn't have like moral standing. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it made me think of that a quote from Eddie Lama, who was who is an animal rights activist. He was the star of the documentary The Witness, and he talked about when he became aware of the extent of farmed animal suffering, and he said, "I couldn't believe it. I was so overwhelmed, and I knew that even when I went vegan, you know, animals would continue to suffer and die. You know, I was just a drop in the bucket. So I knew that animals would continue to suffer and die, but not because of me. And that's what I needed to think about. And so I guess the answer, that is my answer to this question. All we can do, we start with ourselves. You know, we have to wake up with ourselves, and we have to, you know, we have to find a way to stay self-connected. And for me, staying self-connected requires trying to practice my integrity to the best of my ability.
I wish we could go on talking, but maybe another time. thank you so much for the time you took. It was really wonderful getting to know you and also like hearing even more thoughts than what you put in all your books. So yeah, again, thank you for taking the time.
Well, thank you for being such thoughtful hosts and doing such due diligence in the reading and preparation for this. It really makes a difference, and it's really been a pleasure. And one of these days, when the world is different than it is at this moment, we will definitely continue the conversation in person, maybe over dinner or something.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening, everybody. This is our last outro for this season, and we really ran out of ideas.
What do you call a sad cup of coffee?
I don't know.
A depresso.
So for the past 5 minutes, we've been looking for jokes.
What do you call a dog magician?
What?
A labracadabrador.
By far the best one was, what's the difference between good and bad jokes timing? Not like this?
Yes.
It was like this, no?
Yes, but you delivered it poorly.
Can you deliver it again?
No, now we already
deliver it now.
What's the difference between a good joke and a bad joke timing?
You're really very much better. Well, anyways, what we want to say in these outros always is please follow us on Spotify.
What do you call an elephant that doesn't matter?
Oh, an irrelevant.
An irrelevant. Go before. Ahead.
And also, please follow us on Instagram at einpodcafee. And if you want to, you can become part of our Patreon community, which is a very nice group.
Go ahead.
But it was really nice so far. Huh? It's a nice group of people.
Yes.
Where we tell everybody always who's our next guest, and then they can ask the questions they want to ask us in the show. And it's a lot of fun, and you can support our work. And
what
last
do you
but
call
not least,
the fear of being trapped in a chimney?
I don't know.
Claustrophobia.
Because of Santa Claus.
Exactly right.
Funny. And last but not least, we're always super happy when you send letters or messages how you liked the episode. And even if you disliked it, just tell us why, please, so that we can improve.
What do you call a computer that sings?
I don't know.
Adele.
And that's a perfect way to close the season, I think. Thanks for listening, despite our English.
Yeah, stay tuned for the final episode of Kalter Kaffee and the final season finale.
Yes, and we look forward to seeing you in season 3.
Yes.
We have lined up a lot of amazing
Back
guests
with a bang.
Already.
Pew, pew. Skrr.
That was too much.
Yeah. Sorry.
Okay, bye.